Hello, everybody, and welcome to the very first episode of On Becoming. I am your host, Ziva Belil. I could not be more excited to introduce you to my first guest. She's a living treasure to me, Jessica Menendez. Jessica and I studied at the same college together in the 1990s in New York. We had some interactions when we were living on campus, but we really didn't become close until we found ourselves living abroad in Paris on the same study abroad program. So we both had host families in the 13th arrondissement, and we were just a few blocks away, so we were neighbors. And if you've ever lived abroad, you know that having someone you feel close to, who knows a bit about your backstory, can be like a lifesaver during those dark moments when you really feel like a fish out of water. Well, Jessica was that person for me. She's trilingual, so she could navigate any situation with perfect ease, from flirting with French boys to buying metro tickets. Years later, after we graduated college and I was living in New York City and I had started to maybe think about giving up my dream of moving to Paris, Jessica emerged once again as my lifesaver, as my beacon. She and her then French boyfriend, now French husband, Charles, were visiting New York. And during our conversation, they out of the blue were like, "Ziva, what are you doing? You're meant to be in Paris. Come and stay with us for as long as you like." And they gave me that push I think I really needed to leap into my life in Paris. And had they not been there, had they not extended their invitation, I don't know, honestly, if I would have had the courage to come on my own. But besides the personal connection, Jessica is a fascinating woman and has an unbelievable story of her own. She grew up in Guatemala for the first 10 years of her life and then moved to America, where she spent her adolescence and early adult years before finally making her way to Paris permanently. Jessica sees the world through a very unique multicultural lens. But what's it like experiencing reality with three different ways of interpreting it? So we explore that in our conversation, as well as how her background has shaped her work as a film editor and more recently, a film director. In April, Jessica released her first solo documentary through the French-German production company Arte, and it focuses on the fascinating life of the Hollywood actress Kim Novak, but tells her story for the first time through the prism of the post-Me Too era. To make the documentary, Jessica spent several days with Kim Novak on her ranch in Oregon. In this interview you're about to listen to, we talk about the relationship between identity, language, and place, how courage and sacrifice play out in the pursuit of ambitious dreams, and what it means to finally have more women's voices and stories emerging in cinema. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as it meant to me to record it, and that you are blown away in the way that I am by Jessica's story and the way that she sees the world. So before we begin, I wanted to know, and this is something I do with my, you know, with my coaching clients, of course, is to just get a sense of what you would like to experience or get out of this conversation, because I come in with my, you know, my idea of what we might uncover over this conversation. But what would you like to understand better about yourself or shed light on? Is there anything in particular that you'd like to get out of this?
Well, for me, it's just a chance to, I mean, you're one of the best listeners I know forever. So it's just a chance to get to talk to you like we always do. And it's always a treat. I'm doing it mainly for you, but that said, I feel like it's interesting because the questions you're going to ask are things that I think kind of mull around in my head, but I've never actually said them. So I'm curious to see how they'll come out. I looked at the questions last night and I was like, I'm just gonna, you know, I just kind of let them float in my head, but I didn't like try to come up with answers, you know? So I'm just curious to see how the words will come out and if they'll be coherent in any way.
So you're just going to, you're curious to see if you're coherent.
Basically.
Well, I mean, that
No, coherent in the sense is like, is there like, have I really analyzed this myself? I don't know. Sort of, but not like in so many words, you know?
So a understanding of how much you know about the process of your own journey, kind of how much analysis you've given to that, I guess, the reflection and seeing whether or not there are some revelations.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm excited about that too. That's one of the things I love the most when I'm having conversations with anyone is just this kind of magical chemistry of the sharing process, where something comes up, something almost, it's almost like when you're, I assume if you're a massage therapist, which I'm not, but you're kind of feeling around and you're sensing, oh, this is an area where things could be a little bit tight. Let's go and try to loosen it up. And then when you're like, oh, okay, that unblocks some stuff. So I love conversations that are like that, where like, that's interesting.
You found a
she
key
said something
that
over here. They're found a little, yeah, let's go in there and dig a little bit. So I'm excited to have this conversation, which is a different kind of conversation than we would typically have, to ask you some questions that, you know, I feel like I have the answer to, but I probably have none of the rich detail in the answer. So we're going to go on an exploration together.
Yay.
There's a quote that's really interesting by Marianne Wright Edelman, where she says, "You can't be what you can't see." And in so many ways, I've your life, the fact that you moved to Paris before, that you spoke impeccable French without an accent, no one could possibly assume that you weren't already French. Just you're the choices that you made and the way you aligned yourself with your dreams, you always seemed that you were several steps ahead. And it was possible for me to kind of latch on to that vision, like, okay, so Jess did this. This is possible. And I think it's very important for us to be able to see that in our future selves, see someone who's doing what we want to be doing. So I would like for you to kind of go back to wherever you want to start from, because you have such an unusual background, growing up in Guatemala, moving to the U.S. at 10, to give us an idea of, for you, who was the person that you were modeling yourself after, if there was someone, or just an idea that you have about the version of your life that you wanted to grow into?
Modeling after somebody, I guess the closest would probably be my mom. She totally didn't do what I did, but she, at the age of, I think she was around 20, she traveled to Europe for an extended period of time. She stayed in Spain for many, many months. She stayed in a pension, and she was absolutely free. And she loved Europe. She went to Europe. She went to Spain. She went to France. She went to Morocco, hitchhiking to Morocco as a single woman. And she had so many stories of those times. And she brought back all sorts of records and movies from that period. And a lot of them were French. There was Mireille Mathieu. There was The Umbrellas of Cherbourg by Jacques Demy. And they really influenced me. Like, I felt that they were part of her, and they represented, even though her life took a different turn and she didn't necessarily realize her dreams, she loved traveling. She loved other cultures is what she loved, not necessarily traveling. She was just so open to the rest of the world. It represented a time of her life where she was extremely free and just very adventurous. And I really admired that. And the other thing was, I had another connection to France, which is a distant relative on the Guatemalan side, which is very strange. My grandmother, my Guatemalan grandmother, they had a French ancestor, and the French had been passed down. So they all obviously spoke Spanish living in Guatemala, but they had all learned French in school and through different ways. And for them, it was something that they were very proud of, that they had this French ancestor and that they all spoke French. And French to them was very refined. It was like the definition of being refined, and they were very proud of that. And so I think that stuck with me. And so the idea of coming to France, I guess for me, originally it was just a junior year abroad, and it was an obvious choice because I'd learned French in, you know, I started when I was, I guess, 14 or something in school. I had already lived in Latin America, and for me, that was the new experience. And I also loved film, and French cinema, you know, has an amazing reputation. So it was an obvious choice. But for me, you know, it was going to be a year. It was going to be my junior year abroad. But coming here the way I felt, I've never felt anywhere. It just felt, I felt amazing. I felt free. I felt appreciated for who I was, the multicultural me, which I didn't have. I did have in college, somewhat, but definitely not growing up in high school and stuff. Like the fact that I was half Guatemalan was never anything that I talked about, you know, because it didn't interest anybody. It was just kind of this weird detail about me. Whereas in France, people were interested in it. But the main thing was the cultural landscape here. Like, I don't know if you remember, but when we got here, it was like before the internet, and there was a thing called the Pariscope
Oh,
and
yeah.
l'Officiel des Spectacles, a little booklet. And it was literally like a book, you know, of all the films that were being shown that week. So just for a week, you literally had a book of choices of places to go. It was really the cafe culture of like, let's go see a movie and then we'll go to a cafe and sit there for 4 hours and talk, you know, while smoking indoors. Yeah, I felt free. I felt and so when I left, I just didn't, I felt like it. I wasn't, it wasn't over, definitely. Like when I got on that plane, like tears started rolling down my face. And I was happy to go back and finish school, like college, but I was like, this isn't over.
Well, it sounds like what you keep you've said it several times is this idea of freedom, the feeling of freedom, and also what your mom experienced when she was traveling, this kind of free-spirited adventurer, independent woman. Going outside of her comfort zone and collecting experiences in a way that's, I guess, uncommon for, you know, it's uncommon still today, but even more so for a woman in the 60s to be traveling. And I find that interesting, this whole idea of her coming back with souvenirs, film souvenirs of her experience. What do you remember about how you felt when she shared those experiences with you? And when was that? Was that when you were an adolescent, or was that earlier? What do you recall of that moment of that kinship with her, of being kind of almost like a witness to her life?
It started at a very young age because not only did she bring back that music and the film she told me about, she collected, I guess they became Christmas tree decorations, but they were actually small objects from everywhere that she traveled. So our Christmas tree was actually essentially objects from all over the world. They were partially from that trip when she was 20, but also when she was a flight attendant. So when they got married, they did, when she married my dad, they did a world trip, like literally, like they went to India, they went to like, you know, Japan, they went to all sorts of places that, you know, not many people could afford because she was a flight attendant and got like an amazing deal.
I
Not a
had
flight
no idea
attendant.
she
She
was
was
a
on the,
flight
not an
attendant.
attendant. She wasn't in the air. She worked for British Airways and Air France on the ground.
Okay.
But so she was a flight, I guess the woman behind the counter.
Right, a flight facilitator.
Yes. And so all, you know, our entire Christmas tree had these objects and she had a story behind each one, you know, and still does, you know, and I still love hearing all the stories behind each object that is hanging from our tree. And then I guess it would be kind of an early adolescence. We discovered her record collection. You know, my sister and I discovered her record collection, and they were all, you know, it was just it was really cool. And a lot of the records were French. Not a lot of them, but and yeah, quite a few of them. Not all of them is what I meant to say. And
So these souvenirs of her travels and of heavy, heavy French presence.
yes.
And just so remind me, your parents, did they meet because she was a travel agent and your dad was showed up at the counter and bought a ticket from her? That's kind of like the story I have in my mind.
Actually, it did happen in an airport, which is what you have in your mind, but she was actually coming back from her European trip and she had lived in Spain for many months and she saw a woman struggling to speak English because her luggage had been lost. And so she immediately went up to her to help her, you know, translate and just facilitate that. This was, I guess, before she worked at the airport, and helped her find her luggage. And this woman happened to be my aunt Luma, who is amazing. And she was a major partier. And she was like, she's like, I like you. What's your name? Do you like to party? My mom was like, yeah. She was like, give me your number. And a week later she called, she's like, I'm having a party. And it was my aunt Luma, who her whole family had to move to the United States because my grandfather in Guatemala had been kidnapped, sequestered, as a government official, and had escaped on foot and took his entire family to the US. And it happened to be that time. And so she invited my mom to a party, and I actually have, I think it's a 16mm footage of that party where my parents met. So, oh yeah.
So, okay. So your mom is, she's in the airport. She's just gone back from her time living in Spain. She's looking great. She's feeling hot. She sees a woman struggling to express herself in English, and she intervenes to facilitate the conversation. It happens to be your future aunt, mm-hmm. who is a partier and says, hey, I like you, come to my party, and invites her a couple weeks later. And that's where she meets your dad.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is where? Where are we now?
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C. So I love this idea that your mom is, she's coming back. She's experienced the world. She's feeling confident, expressing herself in different languages. And she facilitates this, you know, some kind of help that leads to your parents and your, you know, your parents getting together and your creation further down the line.
Exactly.
So moving between languages plays a role in like your genetics.
Yes. Yes.
So this is interesting because I wanted to ask you, you know, one of the things that I've always admired, and I think everyone is always so shocked by, is your ability to flip between languages and almost shed and, you know, change your skin. You have this unbelievable chameleon-like way of when you speak in French, you are la Parisienne. When you speak in Spanish, people are just like, wait, what just happened? She's now like, who is this person? And then, of course, when you speak in English, you sound Midwestern.
Do I? I don't realize.
I don't really know what Midwestern is, but you just have like a very, you just have like a very neutral accent in English. So mm-hmm. let's just say it's Virginia. I don't know. Is it?
Is it? Yeah. Okay.
It's very kind of clean.
Northern Virginia.
Yeah. Very clean English. So what is that like for you going between different languages, and how do you embody those languages differently? How are they different parts of your personality?
I think definitely language is a door to a different culture and a different mentality. It's not just translating the same thing from one language to another. It represents everything that's behind it, the entire culture. And I think for me, I grew up basically bilingual. Even though I was born in the States, we moved to Guatemala when I was only a few months old. And so my first language was really Spanish. My mother would try to read books to us in English. She had all of her childhood books that she would read. And we would, you know, my sister and I would be like, no, in Spanish, in Espanol. Because as a child, you always want to do what is being done around you, weirdly. When I was 8 and we moved to the States, I had taken English in my elementary school before that. So, but I still, you know, my English was definitely, you know, the way you do when you learn in school. And when you're that young, you know, within 2 months, my mom said we were fluent in English.
Wow.
Because of the age, I think. And so ever since then after that, we didn't want to hear Spanish anymore. We just wanted to do things in English the way our classmates did, you know? And of course, like the life in Guatemala, the people in Guatemala, the family that I had there is just so different from the American, you know, my mom's American family, the way life is in Northern Virginia, the snow, you know, all the traditions are different, the people are different. And so language, it just opens up, I guess, as human beings, we're extremely plastic. You know, we can plastic in the sense of being able to change, and you react to your environment, and you grow from that environment, and your brain expands from a different environment. It has to, in order to adapt and survive. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, English actually, after that, since it was the language of my adolescence and my young adulthood, became my, I would say it's my strongest language. Even though I'm, you know, I speak Spanish and French fluently, English is definitely the language I feel most comfortable in.
Mm.
Like if I want to read a novel and just relax, I want it to be in English. If I'm reading a novel in French, I'm too focused on the grammar. I'm too focused on, oh, you know, that's an interesting turn of a phrase. That's the language is too present. Whereas English, I can just kind of forget the language and just, you know, be in the story.
Mm, so it's kind of like the slipping on a pair of comfortable house shoes. You know, mm-hmm. you just kind of like don't have to try.
Yeah.
So if there's this idea of the English is what you navigate towards, you're drawn towards, if you don't want to have to do any work and just be, but you're absolutely 100% fluent in both Spanish and in French, how do you feel like your identity is shaped by these three different versions of yourself, these three different possibilities?
I think that I am. I think that the fact that I've lived in France for a long time has altered my identity. It obviously it is me, because I'm doing this to myself and I'm evolving with it. But had I stayed in the US, for example, I would probably have a slightly different personality. I think the core of your personality remains the same. You know, I'm a introvert, but I like being social. I think the main thing is sense of humor. It's very cultural. For a long time, even when I began to really master French, the sense of humor is the last thing that, you know, you just can't really translate it. It's all about spontaneity. It's about cultural references. It's about a mindset. French people don't laugh at the same things that Americans do, for the most part. And, you know, you have to be really, really master the language in order to be that spontaneous and have the timing required to have a sense of humor. I think the French are generally more skeptical, more critical, I would say, than Americans. Americans are generally more encouraging. They see everything as possible. And the French, less so maybe today than when we got here, but everything seemed impossible. And you have to convince otherwise, you know, and it's possible to convince, but it's never just like, yeah, amazing, you should go for it, you know, or it's always like, oh, ça va être compliqué, difficile.
Yeah.
Je suis pas sûr, hein? And so that does affect who you are, you know, definitely when you're living in that atmosphere.
I think that's so interesting, this idea that it's the language baked in a culture that shapes that part of your personality, part of your identity. And that if you, I don't know, it sounds like if you want to express a certain side of yourself, you have the capacity to choose the language with its cultural baggage that's the best vehicle for that.
And that's why it's so special to be with friends like you who know both, because the franglais is just the best. Because now, you know, even though English is my most comfortable language, there are some things that are just impossible to get across in the same way in English if you speak French. Mm-hmm. And so with you, we can just kind of go back and forth from one to the other. And then it's perfect, because then it's really comfortable now.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
there are things that are impossible to translate, or, you know, references that just don't work or whatever. And so that double, yeah, there's two, there's definitely like two brains in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I feel like as you say this, I recognize that my comfort zone is being able to communicate with that double, like the double linguistic cultural lens,
yeah,
all baked in. And when someone's not going to make fun of you because you do that. I've had friends in America who'll be like, subtitles, please, because I like slipped in a French word unbeknownst to me. Or even, I think it was Rob, like, even just like some kind of grammatical quirkiness, like saying like, what are you talking about? No one says that. So what I want to do now is kind of like flip the story so that we can look at this notion of slipping into the skin of a part of your identity, which seems like it's a major theme for you as an individual. And also, because I just saw the phenomenal documentary that you made about Kim Novak. And there, for me, was a really strong undercurrent in that movie around this, the tension of identity and the role that you play and what's, you know, what are the expectations and how you decide where you feel most comfortable identity-wise, specifically with Kim Novak having played two women in Vertigo, Madeline and Judy. And it's really it's a central moment in the film. And I just want to know, how did her story of playing double identities kind of resonate with your own story? And was that an element that you feel like you were looking to unpack and dig into?
Yes. I've always been kind of hypnotized by Vertigo. It's definitely my favorite Alfred Hitchcock movie. And it's mainly due to that, this woman that plays two roles. Why? Because one is the real woman and the other one is a fantasy woman. The fantasy woman to me represents what the woman that society tells us we should be. So the physical beauty, the kind of mysterious, alluring quality. And the other woman is just your regular, ordinary woman. And you can take that woman and turn her into this other woman, and which is what Hollywood did to all of the actresses. And I've been, you know, since I love movies from the 1950s, from the 1940s. And when you see those women, they're just creatures. They're not actually ordinary women. They're not the type of women that you just see at your dinner table or at a restaurant, or, you know, they are these creatures, but they were created. And I love going back and seeing how they were created. And in the Hitchcock movie Vertigo, you see the creation process and how it came about. It's Jimmy Stewart. And he's like, I want you to wear this. I want you to turn your hair like this. You know, I want you to be blonde. I want you to not wear this makeup. I want you to be this way. I find that really, really interesting. And then, so she's living, when she agrees to turn into her, she is both women at the same time. So she's playing a role for others that is more acceptable. And then, but she's obviously still herself in there, and she tries to keep a part of herself, which I find really interesting. She keeps her way of speaking. Madeline speaks in a very kind of upper class, very, you know, soft-spoken and mysterious. And Judy has a very kind of working girl type of accent. And she keeps it when she dresses like Madeline, but is still Judy. She keeps that voice. And that's where I think Kim was a genius in the way she interpreted it.
Yeah, I'm getting like goosebumps thinking about that.
Again, you know, language, the voice is something that, you know, you can change your physical appearance, but that is really who you are.
How do you feel that concept of embodying two versions of self, where there's the fantasy? And I mean, when you say that, maybe the dictates in the 40s and 50s were different from they are today, but there's still certain expectations about how a woman is supposed to look and be, and what we're supposed to prioritize in our lives. So in an abstract way, that is the fantasy. There's a fantasy version, an ideal version of femininity and of womanhood today.
I think it's just become exacerbated. I think that it was already really extreme in the 50s. Like when Kim talks about her Hollywood transformation, I mean, it's pretty extreme. And even, you know, if you look at somebody like Rita Hayworth, like she literally totally transformed. You would barely recognize her, you know, from Margarita Cancino to Rita Hayworth. I mean, it's just like she becomes this screen goddess. And before she was this beautiful, you know, Latina woman, mm-hmm. you know, and she turns into this like redheaded bombshell, you know. And what I find interesting is that they're women that I feel like have really shaped the expectations of what the ideal woman should look like. And they're very kind of paralyzing for women because it takes a lot of work. It's like basically a full-time job to be that creature, that screen goddess, you know? And today it's just become exacerbated with social media and, you know, all these like influencers who have the perfect lighting and the perfect filters and the right angle. And all of that is, you know, has been inherited from the Hollywood era where physical appearance is key. And it's become even more so, I think, instead of less so. You'd hope that today...
Right. It's different. You don't have a team of people.
Yeah, it's a team of people. It takes it's a lot of work. And I do think that it creates a certain feeling of like an inferiority complex in a lot of women.
So what is the intention then of exposing that in a way in the documentary for you?
Well, exposing it means, no, she wasn't born this way. And it exposes also the cost to the person, because even though she is that screen goddess herself, Kim Novak or Rita Hayworth or Marilyn Monroe, they are still the old version of themselves inside. And that's what Kim really struggled with. And I think it was Rita Hayworth who said, it's attributed to Marilyn Monroe, but it's actually Rita Hayworth said, men go to bed with Gilda and they wake up with me. She's still there. She's not a screen goddess. She's not a femme fatale, you know? She's an introverted woman who just wanted to have a cozy life, you know, a cozy family life. That's all she ever dreamed of. And so men would get kind of disappointed that she wasn't this like seductress, you know, creature in bed or otherwise, because that's just not who she was. And Kim was definitely not a sex symbol in her own mind. She wanted all sorts of different other roles. And it's very limiting. It's very limiting. Just as walking in very high heels is limiting, having that appearance is limiting physically, emotionally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every time you say this, every time you evoke this idea of two parts of yourself included in a package, that there's the projected version and then inside there's the true person. Every time you say that, there's something that really kind of gives me resonates. This, there's so much that I wind up doing with clients that has to do with this unpacking of what society has loaded us down with in terms of the way we're supposed to be, which winds up getting into your brain in ways that are really, really subtle. The way that the beliefs that we have, the standards we hold ourselves to. And there's a real like renaissance that happens when you can see those layers for what they are.
I think it's really important to expose the behind the scenes work on all of that. It really helps people to see the reality of it, and that, you know, everybody else is just an ordinary person too, and that this is kind of a magic show, you know?
Right. And that's what the series, the Arte series is about. It's kind of going behind the scenes and exploring the identity of Hollywood icons. Is that how?
It really depends. It can be musicians, it can be people from today. I mean, there's films on Brad Pitt or Johnny Depp or people from the past. It can be Ida Lupino, which is amazing. But it each film has its own angle. And this angle was something that I chose to talk about in terms of Kim Novak. Because she's been kind of forgotten because she left Hollywood. And she left Hollywood because she had no other choice. You know, she wanted to express herself artistically, whether it be on a canvas or acting, but she she realized that she was only going to be this sex symbol forever. And she was like, this is not interesting to me. So a lot of women left or died.
Right.
I mean, Judy Garland was in her 40s. Marilyn Monroe, I think, was 36. Like, it really was not, it was a very toxic environment for women at the time. And unfortunately, I mean, when you see the Me Too movement, this is kind of what got me looking back into the past to see how all of this was still possible today. It has not changed that much. It hasn't changed that much. And luckily, it's starting to. Michelle Yeoh just won the Oscar for Best Actress at 60. I think it's a first, or similar to, and probably Meryl Streep must have gotten something. But yeah, it's very rare. This idea that by 40, women are past their
Well, there's
prime.
also the notion of what are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do next? And
Well, so
so,
much of our identity is built on our appearance for women.
yes, yeah.
So much of it, and it's ephemeral, and you know that it's going to go away. It's like this constant fear of, becoming the invisible woman at 40, All women feel it. Suddenly it's like you go from object of desire to you don't exist. And neither of those are really fun,
Right.
There is a certain freedom of no longer being the object of desire. There is, but you don't want to be invisible either. And it's very difficult to find the in-between where you just feel good and find meaning and realize that, appearance is not important, but it's really hard. Even when you think about it, even when you're against it, it's still important and you
Right.
can't ignore it.
Right. And that's when you build up, it's the work is about building up a sense of self that goes beyond the value attributed to you physically.
Yes, and that's work.
And that's
It's
work.
work in this society. It's a lot
Yeah.
of work.
Well, she had the privilege, it seems, of knowing since she was a little girl what she wanted to do, which is not something that many people have. And I mean, I keep doing these kind of back and forth parallels between the two of you, but you and Kim, two peas in a pod. But when I think about, so you decided to make this documentary, you wrote and directed it, and this is the first time, if I'm not mistaken, that you have gone back to writing and directing after working as an editor for
Since 2009.
couple.
Yeah.
Okay. So what, why was this the moment for you to reconnect with writing and directing?
I feel like the editing has really, when I chose to do editing, basically, is because it was the creative aspect of filmmaking that interested me the most. A director will go on a film shoot. A director, goes works with a musician. A director does all sort of, there's a writing process, obviously, whether it's in documentary and fiction, you write something, then you shoot it, and then you edit it. And the editing part always seemed to me the most interesting aspect. When you start out in film, you can't just be like, I want to be a director. You kind of have to know a lot of stuff to be a director because it's a complete job. It's like a, chef d'orchestre. And so editing seemed to me the best way to learn filmmaking by also having a job that could be a career that could help me earn my living. Directing is not, unless you're like Steven Spielberg, it's not. That's not where all the money's at compared to how much time you spend on a project. And it takes so long. I mean, you see a lot of directors, it takes 7 years to get something to, from the point where you had the idea to the point where the film actually comes out. It's been 7 years. It's a lot of work. And I just, some people are lucky to have family support when they want to do something like that. Like, I want to direct, and their family is like, here, we have this country house. You can just go live there and write your project, and we'll make sure you won't starve to death. I definitely didn't have that. And I always felt like, I started working at 13 as a babysitter, and 15, my first, as soon as I was of legal age, I started working at a video club, which we can get to if that's interesting or not. But the video club that got me into foreign films. So I needed to find something that I liked, which would take me to my ultimate goal, but that would be a job that I could rely on to make a living. And I also love editing. Like, it's like the Kim Novak documentary. There was one film shoot. It was basically interviews. It was the interview of Kim Novak and the interview of the film historians. So the most of the work was actually finding all the archives, which is basically I'm creating my own footage. So I work with a researcher, but also much of that is done by me looking for footage. And then how do you put it all together? You know, like that to me in documentary, especially editing is, a lot of films are made in the editing room. So most of the films that I've edited recently are between 200 and 300 hours of footage. So you can imagine that with those 300 hours, you're going to make a film that's an hour 45. There's a lot of leeway in what story you're going to tell. And the dramatic arc it's going to take. Who are your characters? How do you bring about emotion? What works? What doesn't work? And that editing really teaches you that, because you're like, God, why didn't they shoot this? You know, or if they just shot it this way, then it would work. And so it's like the best way to learn filmmaking, I think, is by seeing the final result and seeing what's missing, what works, what they should have done, you know, what was amazing and what they did do that, like, you really kind of need in a film for it to work. And so it's been kind of my formation.
So how do you feel that formation? So you knew, you said that your end game, your end goal has been to write and direct, but working as an editor has been fulfilling and has given you the skills and the experience to be able to make the story that much more evocative and emotional and embody the intention setting out when you're imagining what you want to achieve with the film. So where do you stand now? Would you, having this, you know, experience under your belt of editing, are you thinking that you want to continue to work primarily as an editor, or is this your kind of Kim Novak moment where you know, sell the house, move to another Lutheran mother state, change your name, and just like live out the dream of being the director and the writer of your future movies?
Ideally, I think I would do both. Because editing, what I love, is kind of like speaking another language. You're going into the universe of another person. So this is something that somebody else dreamed up, whether it's documentary or fiction. It's like, you know, the last one, you know, one of the, my most recent documentary as an editor is called Last Dance. It's actually out right now in the MK de Beaubourg. It had 300 hours of footage. And, you know, the director, Colleen, she was entranced with a drag queen from New Orleans. This, you know, kind of iconic drag queen. And it's, you know, her experience. I've never been to New Orleans. I don't know this drag queen. Her obsession is kind of like metamorphosis, like how you can, as one person, change into another. So it really opens your mind to other things. And she had beautiful footage that she shot. So it was like a treat to be able to work on it. So it's very different from when you have your own idea and something. Basically, when you make a film, you have something to say. My things that I want to, I know that I have things I want to say, and they've actually been building up for many years. So I literally have like, I think I could probably have enough films until I die that I want to make. Mm-hmm. So that's not a problem. It's more about how long it takes and what's feasible in terms of being able to live off of that, you know, especially in documentary. I think fiction film, if you make one that's a success, I think financially you'll be okay. In documentary, like, you really have to churn one out at least once a year, if not two, which seems impossible to me given the amount of work that I put into the Kim Novak documentary. But I'm also a perfectionist.
So for you, ideally, it's a combination of writing, directing. You have an endless supply of material that you can put together, and also kind of sounds like taking a little bit of a vacation from yourself and entering into someone else's world and being able to absorb by proxy some of the ways that they see the world that could be really enriching to you. So for I'm curious to know, for you, we touched on this at some point, this notion of having a goal and then also realizing that in your day-to-day, you need something else in order to sustain yourself. And so editing was a way for you to both satisfy your financial needs and also your creative desires. So what do you feel have been some of the biggest sacrifices that you've had to make on your journey to become the truest version of yourself creatively?
Well, the biggest sacrifice has been putting off a lot of the things that I want to say and do, some things which have been made by other people even, which is always, you know, quite a frustration. It also comes from, I would have liked to be able to edit and have more time to work on my own projects. And really, it's been all consuming, because editing is all consuming. And it's, you know, made it so that it's taken this long to get back into directing. And it's taken time away from family, taken time away from friends, from like just even like going to the doctor. Like I literally, you know, get bald, you know, I get yelled at by all my doctors. They're like, I haven't seen you in 6 years. What's wrong? You know, I don't have time for myself, really. And that's a problem. And I do, and I'm not alone in this, with other editors are very similar.
So what, there's like a tunnel vision experience that happens where you just like, the image that comes to mind is, you know, just kind of in a dark room. You don't even know, you have no notion of the day, you know, what time of the day or day of the week it is.
Yeah, I think it's just very time consuming. There are deadlines which are always too short. And so you find yourself working late, you find yourself working on the weekends. There's just never enough time. And it's also consuming in terms of your brain. Like you're literally, there's never a moment where you can like, oh, I'm going to look at my emails or I'm going to just make this phone call. It's like, you don't, you're just working on that. You're focused on one film. Your mind is filled with 300 hours of footage, which you have to master, you know, and you have to know, like you start putting the pieces of the puzzle together, and that's a lot of material. And so it takes up a lot of brain space. Like even when I'm coming home, you know, in the metro, my brain is still going. When I go to bed at night, I'm like, oh my God, what if I put that with that? Or like, yes, of course, that's the thing that, and I'm like writing down things in a notebook. It's, and so just even mentally, it's hard to have space for anything else.
So what would you change?
I would change that. I would do less of that, have some time to myself, and also have time for my projects, which means I need to clone myself into at least 2 to 3 people would be ideal.
Okay. Well, what's actually realistic?
That is my problem. I'm always kind of in the ideal world, but that doesn't exist. So win the lottery. Is that realistic enough?
No. Okay. You can't control that. Something
I'm
you can control.
Leibowitz. I don't want to win the lottery. I need to win
the lottery. I somehow think that even if you did win the lottery, you would still show up 45 to 50 minutes late to your rendezvous.
Oh God, maybe.
But that's the thing. It's like within your control. What do you think you can change?
I honestly don't know that I can change that much. Like Sean and I have talked about this too, in terms of his job. Like it's really hard when you have to make a living. You kind of have to take when things come along. You can't just like be like, oh, I just finished a film. Like, I'm not going to take this one. Because if you don't take it, then they may not call you for another 8 months. And by that time, you'll be starving, you know? So it's kind of like you're on this train. And there is the intermittent du spectacle in France. But it's not as ideal as it seems because, you know, if you're earning a decent salary, suddenly when you're not working, you are getting a stipend, but it's like $1,300. And try living in Paris with that, you know, you can live maybe a couple months and you're using up your savings. But if you try to do any longer than that, And, you know, for example, like whether it's a screenplay or a documentary, unless you're a well-known director and somebody pays you to write it, usually for the most part, all of the research and writing is on your own time.
Wow. That's also part of the process that you get really into, the research. And I can imagine like also digging around for material. So it sounds almost like it's accepting that there's going to be, you can only do so much within a certain amount of time and the result may not be perfect.
Right. That's the hard one for me, that the result may not be perfect. I usually am very exigeant and I will kill myself to make it perfect.
Right.
I will stay up till 6 in the morning. I will, you know, go. Kim likes that about me though. She's a perfectionist.
She knows that at any time she could just reach out and you'll be right there.
Yeah.
So I want to now know, based on everything that we've kind of explored, going, you know, into the past, into your family life, into your career and language, what are, you know, based on our beginning intentions, what's emerged here for you that you're going to take with you? And maybe there's some seeds that you feel like you want to plant. What were the les prises de conscience, the aha moments, if there were any?
I think it's more about how long it's taken, you know, it's true what you say that since college, I figured out that I really wanted to be a director and direct mostly documentary films. And it's crazy that it's taken this long. And something we haven't really talked about yet is that, you know, today, finally, women are being, since Me Too, basically, it's not just about sexual harassment. It's about Time's Up as well. It's about, you know, women earning less, women not being in positions of power. It's that quote that you said at the beginning. Can you tell it to me again? You can't be what you can't see. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it makes me emotional. Seeing all these women using their voice is really powerful.
Yeah.
Really powerful. And you know, I think there is a difference in storytelling between women and men. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but generally I think there is. And when we read books, like, I know that I love the Bronte sisters. Why? Because they have a way of expressing themselves, or even themes that women can relate to. And in movies, it's very obvious. You know, obviously when I see a film, this action-packed movie with special effects, I'm like, that's not me. You know, it can be fun to watch, but I would never want to have that as a job. And I wouldn't even know where to begin. Then you're like, well, then am I not a filmmaker? Because I could never, you know, do this kind of movie. And when you see women directors, you're like, yes, of course, that makes sense. You know, you're filming her like this and you're telling this story. And actually those stories didn't seem to have much importance. There wasn't much, you know, desire to hear them. And that's been my road has been, actually, your voice does have importance. There are people out there that want to hear it. It's not a weird point of view or one that nobody can relate to or identify with. There are actually people that are starving to hear these stories, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what has changed a lot. And there's more respect also for women and what they're able to do.
And you are a woman telling stories of women and their voices and their struggles and also their pushback from the protocol and the expectations. And, you know, the time it has taken you to get to where you are is the time it's taking you to get to where you are.
I hope so. I'll give you an example, though, that's very concrete. When I was interested in Kim Novak, I read her biographies. And one of the main biographies written by a man called The Reluctant Goddess, which was actually a good title, basically goes from each relationship from one man to the other. That's the structure of the book. She was with so-and-so. she dated this person when she was in high school, you know, the football star. And then she was with Matt Crim, then she was with Frank Sinatra, then she was with Cary Grant, then she was, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, Kim said she had already, over the years, she had many offers to do documentaries on her, but a lot of them involved, you know, her telling the stories of the famous men that she dated. In one of the very first interviews I saw of her in the 1950s, they're like, what was it like working with Tyrone Power? What was it like working with William Holden? Oh, what's Frank Sinatra like? And I was like, you've got Kim Novak in front of you. Do you want to know about her? You know, so this is why it's important to have a different perspective. Even somebody like Elizabeth Taylor, people love talking about her 8 marriages, you know, and Richard Burton and her life, you know, all these divorces and stuff. And that's just not what I'm interested in. And I think that that's what Kim liked about my project. And, you know, my viewpoint on her is what really convinced her to open up.
So what are you leaning into then creatively? What do you want to achieve? What's the impact that you want to make through your creative projects?
I think that the most important thing is getting across a viewpoint. I think it definitely it's from a female perspective for the most part, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, I'm not, it's hard to describe, but I definitely think there are a lot of problems in this world. And I feel like I can add my voice to it and give people, you know, different ways of seeing and options that can be positive. I like films, like if I chose Kim, I read a lot about old Hollywood and, you know, Marilyn Monroe and Judy Garland. There's a lot of victimization, and they were victims in many ways. But I really wanted to do Kim because she fought and she won in many ways. She stood up for herself. And I think of her as being 20 years old and standing up to one of the big 5 studio heads. There were only 5. He was the meanest, most tyrannical mogul. And she's like, I'm not going to change my name. She's 20. Do you remember what we were like when we were 20? You know,
yeah.
Unbelievable. And she's asking for something that seems actually so unreasonable for the time, is to keep an ethnic foreign name. You know, it was just not done. It wasn't like, oh, I'd rather have, you know, Stuart instead of whatever, you know, some other English sounding name. So she really did stand up for herself. And I think we need stories like that of people that give us like a roadmap also, that we don't have to take it. We can stand up for ourselves. It's not easy. It has a price often, but it's the best option if you want to live with yourself. And I do feel that films should give hope in some way. You can talk about really hard things, but I think that when you're, a lot of the news today is just so dark and depressing, and the world is dark and depressing, but I think bad news sells more than good news as well. And there is a way to turn things so that we can be active participants and making things better instead of just wallowing in this like darkness and depression.
Well, I think that is a wonderful, optimistic and empowering message to end with. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for exploring all of these amazing and fascinating facets together. And I can't wait to see more of what you put out into the world. This has definitely whet my appetite. And I think that your perspective and your voice and your vision and your layered lens is a fascinating prism that we can all really benefit from seeing through more of. So make those movies, okay?
I will. And I'm very excited for this podcast. I like your concept. It's very interesting to see how people became who they are and the path that takes them there. And sometimes, I mean, I'll just end with this. It's just kind of crazy because that day that you remember so clearly when I was like, come stay on my sofa, if you remember it, it's because it's a time when your life, it could have gone in a whole other direction.
Yeah.
For better or for worse, we don't know, you know?
We don't know.
I have a whole alternate me that's in the States and another one that's in Guatemala, and those lives haven't been,
I know. Well,
you know,
that's a
I don't want to get all
that's a movie.
Everything everywhere all at once, you know, mm-hmm. this alternate universe. Mm. Yeah, I remember so clearly the day that I, you know, what ended. It was very similar to you, actually. I had Monique Lacaux, Juliette's mother, mm. Tell me when I got a scholarship to go to film school. She was like, because I had the money to pay the school, but the rest, what else do I do? You know, it's like I had money to live, like to pay for an apartment. Or she was like, you can come back and stay with us, you know. And yeah. they made it possible for me. So I'm glad mm. that I was able to do that for you. But those are moments that really change yeah. your destiny.
More couches need to be offered up to people.
That's- yes.
to make it possible. Thank you again, sweetheart. I am so appreciative of having your time and your attention and would love to hear anything you have to say, any feedback, any questions, any requests. You can leave me a voice message if you go to speakpipe.com/onbecoming. That's speakpipe, speakpipe.com/onbecoming. I promise to get back to you. If this podcast has touched you, inspired you, transformed you in any way, it would mean the world to me if you would leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast listening platform.